Okay, I think we're gathered, and I think we'll get going. Bagel, teach business at Concordia College, New York, and also direct international studies there. We're going to talk about sort of like the road to 9/11 and the rise of resentment. And we're going to try and walk through how the Middle East got to where it is today. We're not going to talk about, we're going to talk about Islam, but we're not going to talk about the most populous Islamic country, which is Indonesia, which is a very different breed of cat than the Middle East. In my corporate life, I spent a lot of time in the Middle East, from Morocco to Egypt to Israel, to Saudi, to Yemen, and also a fair amount of time in Turkey, all Muslim countries, but huge spectrum politically on where they are. Some very orthodox, very conservative, very Wahhabi, and others, let's say with Turkey, which is secular, and is a very modern state and progressive. They brew decent beer. they have good rights for women, and a lot of the work I did was in the 90s in Turkey. And Şiler was a woman prime minister. And you compare that to the mullahs in Iran or the House of Saud in Saudi, and you're in a different place. So we're going to talk, we need to keep this in context of a broad spectrum of Islam. It is not at all monolithic, and it is a huge divide within it. But nonetheless, we want to talk about this rise of resentment in much of the Arab world against the West, and we are part of the West. And we're going to walk through a number of pieces of history where I want the sense of this to be the sort of cumulative effect of not succeeding and being put down by the West. And so we really just need to start with the, Islam developed in the 7th century and then was expansionist and expanded, through all North Africa, expanded up into Spain, and almost, through the Pyrenees, which is the mountain range in between France and Spain. And there's famous literature, the Song of Roland, and Charles Martel, was when the Moors were stopped and defeated, but they were in Spain for a long time, for several centuries. Coming around the other side of the Med were the Ottomans, the Ottoman Turks. The Ottomans actually had several empires, and there was a bit of sort of like we talk about the glaciers here, there was some ebb and flow over the centuries. They were very powerful through many centuries, and controlled everything, from parts of modern-day Greece, all the way through, of course, Asia Minor, down into Syria, Palestine, Iraq, all the way down into Saudi, and the two holy cities of Mecca and Medina were once under the governance of the Ottoman Empire. Three holy cities of Islam, I left one out, which is it?
Jerusalem.
So Jerusalem, Mecca, and Medina, three holy cities, three holy sites in Islam. And we should go to a date, 1683, where the Ottoman Turks had come through Eastern and Central Europe, had taken Budapest, and then proceeded to the gates of Vienna. And there's famous artwork about the gates of Vienna. And it was in 1683 where at the gates of Vienna, the Ottoman Turks were defeated. And you know, had they taken, you know, who knows where they would have gotten through into other parts of the Holy Roman Empire. So that's a seminal event in many parts of the Arab world as you know, when the West pushed back and defeated defeated Islam. And it's very interesting and perhaps coincidental that the date of that great defeat in 1683 was September 11th. Which is right. So that was the climatic battle, or is pointed to as a climatic battle between Islam and Western civilization. I think it's overstating it, but some people say since then Islam has not found a way to reconcile itself with what some would call the modern world, and has been pushed back since then. So we're going to jump ahead. Just keep that in mind. You know, there's been this tension, this conflict, open warfare with the West. The West, you know, bent and then came back, and much of the Arab world, then Islamic world, kind of backed away. The next day we should come forward is to 1918. Okay, and this was the end of the Great War to end all wars, WW1. And in this war, the Ottomans and the Ottoman Empire carried all the way through to 1918, and had been allied with Germany and Austria-Hungary. So they, you know, we choose up sides, they pick wrong. If you've, anybody seen the movie Lawrence of Arabia? Great classic movie. Okay, if you haven't, please see it. It's part, you know, it shows a part of that struggle as how the Turks were slowly defeated, you know, and were thrown out of much of the Middle East and Damascus, and ultimately up into Asia Minor. Interestingly, though, Turkey as a country maintained its integrity. There were some border changes, but pretty much the same. What happened when the Ottoman Empire sort of imploded? It was decaying on the inside anyway. But they're back up in Asia Minor. What then would happen to all those provinces that they had been governing? And there was sort of a political vacuum. And after World War I, there was the League of Nations, which is the precursor to the UN. And they, you know, to the victor go the spoils, in a sense, and they granted what were called mandates to the Brits and the French to administer these Ottoman provinces that the Ottomans were no longer there. There wasn't anybody governing them. And basically everything south of Turkey was known as mandates. So you had Syria, you had the Lebanon, you had Iraq, Transjordan, and you had Palestine. Jumping ahead, so the world is changing, okay? And the Ottoman Turk, the Islamic tradition, they lost to the West. And the Ottoman Empire was gone. It was tough to be ruled by the Ottomans, perhaps, but those Ottomans were Muslims, and now we're run by infidels in the West, and it was hard to take. Interesting, though, the next year we could go to 1919, which is the rise of Atatürk, who was a modernist in Turkey, and I think a quite remarkable switch of direction for a country. He turned Turkey from looking backward, and he said, okay, let's look at the world, what works, what doesn't work. The Ottoman Empire was sort of decaying on the inside. Let's look at why the West was successful. Let's not go back to the Middle Ages, let's go forward. And Atatürk learned from the West, and he's been roundly criticized for this. But the Turks followed Atatürk to make a secular republic. And where there was equality for women, he changed the language. So they now use our Western alphabet. They don't use Arabic script. think about doing that. You know, everybody say, by next Thursday, everyone in this room is going to start writing in Arabic. Okay? And it's a pretty tumultuous thing, but it went through. And he also displaced Sharia law, which is Islamic law. It's not necessarily Quranic, but it is the tradition that has evolved over time. And he said, we're not going to have Sharia law in Turkey anymore. And he also abolished the caliphate. And the caliph, there are actually a couple caliphs at one time, just like there are a couple popes at one time. But the caliph means the successor to the prophet. So it was like the most revered spokesperson for Islam. And he said, we're not going to have that in our modern state of Turkey. Okay. In parts of, even in the 50s and 60s and 70s, parts of the Arab world, Ataturk, mannequins of Ataturk were burned. He were burned in effigy because he had, perception was he turned his back to the traditions of Islam and had created a modern state. While Turkey is a secular Islamic state, it is not a hardline Islamic state, let's say, like Saudi. Moving forward in the 1920s, the House of Saud, which is the, you know, why you have Saudi Arabia is because of the House of Saud, really took over the Arabian Peninsula. You know, around the bottom of the Arabian Peninsula, you have Yemen, and that's where the Bin Laden family came from Yemen. They're originally not from Saud, and then they moved and became very, very wealthy in the oil boom of the 70s in construction. But anyway, that the Bin Laden family is a Yemeni background. So Ibn Saud, the sort of the patriarch of the family, formed the country as in 1932, and did it by the sword. So there were these different factions, but he overran them all. Today there's King Abdullah is a direct descendant of Ibn Saud. Today there's 28 million folk in Saudi Arabia, 6 million of which are foreign workers. And if we have time, we can talk a bit later about Saudi. In the population, people that actually work, the majority of people actually work are those foreign workers. Not 100%, but, you know, 52-51%. So the majority of workers in Saudi are actually foreign workers. It's a very interesting pecking order ethnically within that piece. As we all know, the House of Saud cut a deal with the conservative clerics to give the House of Saud legitimacy. Okay, because this was when the country was formed in 1932. This was still contentious between different Arab tribes, and so these became part of the co-opted to become part of the elite to control the country. And so this Wahhabi ultra-conservative part of Islam, the strain within Islam, was then became the strain of Islam in Saudi. Okay, during we're moving through the 20th century, Egypt was at this time developing anti-colonial rhetoric. Here you had the Brits and the French, the Brits were in Egypt, and there was resistance, obviously, to this traditional occupying, although powerful, force. And at this time, this was the rise of the Muslim Brotherhood, which is actually, it's still very much alive, it's still very much a political force, and the elites, Mubarak and the elites in Egypt are very worried about them and periodically will throw a bunch of them in jail. And this is the precursor to Al-Qaeda. So Al-Qaeda is an offshoot of the Muslim brotherhood. Interestingly, a number of the Arab states, the Arabists, they ally themselves with sort of fascist view of the world at this time. Okay. We're going to jump ahead to World War II, and after which the Middle East states gained their independence. UK gave up the Mandate of Palestine, and the region was partitioned into by the UN into Arab and Jewish states. Okay. While there had been Jews in the Middle East, obviously, for a long time, and Jewish communities in many of the countries, also in Turkey, it's interesting, there was and there is a very vibrant Jewish community in Istanbul, and the Turks are very proud of that community, that community is not put upon, that they have all the rights and protections, and that they are a secular Islamic state that is tolerant, and that's part and parcel of who they are as a country, and so that to me is very interesting. But when Israel was, after World War II, was created as a state, and recognized, obviously first by the United States, but then, was granted seating at the UN, Israel was seen as a colonial outpost of the West. And in a way, understandably, that there was already this resentment against the West for occupation, through the mandates, and we're going all the way back to 1683, where the West pushed back. The Arab states, the Ottoman Turks, lost. Here they lost again in World War I. In World War II, result Israel right in the middle, and seen again as a colonial outpost, and all the Arab states refused to accept this. Moving to 1948, okay, this was, depending on your point of view, whatever your point of view, this was a seminal year. This is one of those hinge dates in the Middle East history, where in the Arab world this was seen as a great fiasco and embarrassment, because in 1948 the Arab state said, okay, we're just going to push the Israelis into the sea. And the kicker there was that the five nations of Egypt, and Egypt had 86 million people. It's the most populous Arab state in the Middle East. Egypt, Syria, Transjordan, Lebanon, and Iraq. Okay, five nations, the combined armies were going to, and they were. They said, how can we lose? Okay, we're going to push the Israelis into the sea. And for those of you that that have been to Israel, you know that Israel is a beach. Okay, it's tiny. You get rolling, you get some headwind. You can't stop. You're gonna push them into the water. And yet, in 48, the combined armies of five Arab states could not beat 500,000 Israelis. Israelis, with your back to the wall, to the water, you're gonna fight. You have nowhere else to go. The European experience wasn't exactly a good one. You're back to the wall, back to the Med. You will fight like no one can fight. And the Israelis call it the War of Liberation. In Arabic, the Arabs call it al-Nakba, and that means the catastrophe. How could this possibly happen? There's a march of time through history that these Arab states are getting. We are the superior culture, we Arabs. We've got the superior religion. Why can't we succeed against this infidel West and against this colonial outpost of just 500,000? Okay. So this was this al-Nakba, this catastrophe. And then what happened, you get in much of the Middle East this sort of embarrassment, and say, well, it had to be something wrong with our government. So then the governments of these countries became progressively radical. And especially the key state is Egypt, because if Egypt is in play, war is possible against Israel. Without Egypt, it proved it's not possible against Egypt. And here came the rise of Abdel Nasser. He came to power, I believe he was a colonel, came to power in a coup. And he was a progressive. He talked about socialism and land reforms, and was trying to move Egypt forward. Okay, you go to Cairo, it's a modern cosmopolitan city. Okay, this is not people running around with donkeys and sheep. This is not at all that perception. And so he was trying to move, I won't say he was looking at Ataturk, but he was trying to move in a more progressive way to make Egypt a modern country. And so he needed to do this forward, and he didn't want to align himself with the United States, and he aligned himself with the Soviets. Now, the Christian West, we are people of the book, but the Soviets were true atheists, okay, by dogma, okay. And so the Muslim Brotherhood, which is in great opposition to Nasser, even though Nasser was sort of the great figure in the Middle East, he had aligned himself with Khrushchev. Khrushchev sent in a bunch of engineers. They built the Aswan Dam, helped with modernization and infrastructure in Egypt. But in aligning himself with the atheist Soviets, again, he drew the ire of the Muslim Brotherhood, and Nasser just threw them all in jail. And he tortured them and killed them. And so there's this big animosity. Just an interesting anecdote. The U.S. wasn't totally uninvolved. It tried to have some influence with Egypt and gave some aid to the Nasser's government. And Nasser took that money and built a mosque. It wasn't really what the money was intended for. What you know, some taxpayer in Iowa was giving money to the U.S. government so they could build a mosque in Cairo. And with people in Cairo today will point to it with a twinkle in their eye and say, you know, that's the American mosque. So there's this rise against modernity, right? The Muslim Brotherhood, this friction. He puts them in jail. Move forward to 1967. There was considerable domestic unrest and disquiet in the Arab states. And to divert domestic unrest, this is a theme in history sometimes. So to divert domestic unrest, Egypt, Iraq, Syria, and joined by Jordan, tried again to destroy Israel. And this was the Six-Day War. And they lost, and Israel took over the West Bank, they took over Gaza, and you remember the pictures of Moshe Dayan with the eye patch going into Jerusalem. There was great friction between these powers. They weren't coordinated, and Syria had promised Jordan air cover during the war. And so Jordan went in with all its tanks, and tanks without air cover are no longer. And so we'll come back to this, but there was 67, and then in 73 was the Yom Kippur War, and Jordan didn't go in because they didn't want to join because they didn't trust their other partners. Okay. After the Six-Day War, again, this is another drumbeat of we really tried. You know, we had Soviet weaponry, we had a lot of it, and we got beat. And how could this be? So again, blame government. And then we had authoritative leaders come up. In Libya, we had, of course, Gaddafi came. Iraq, we had Hussein. In Syria, we had Assad came to power. They were hardline, quite impressive. And any liberalization that had happened with women went by the by. 1970s, the rise of oil production, and John can talk about this better than I, but when you have oil production, there's also this thing called the curse of oil, and you look at some of the more screwed up countries in the world, they have a lot of oil, because you have, in a sense, economic stagnation. You don't, and you have political stagnation. You don't have to modernize, you don't have to evolve, you don't have to invest in your people, you don't have to you don't have to modernize your society. Okay, you've got oil. You know, and Saudi doesn't even pump oil yet. Stick a pole in, you know, pipe in the ground, and there's enough pressure. It's still coming. And you look at the economies without resources, without oil. You look at Switzerland. Okay, what's Switzerland got? It's got rocks. It's got cows. Japan's second largest economy in the world. They've got nothing. You look at South Korea, what do they got as resources? Not much. Okay. Look at Singapore, classic example. Singapore has absolutely nothing. Singapore is a city, and yet it is a major economic tiger in Asia, and they invest in their people hugely. And they understand that that's the way of modernity, and that's the way to grow. So this curse of oil, when life is sort of simple and easy, and you don't have to be an entrepreneur, you don't have to think on your feet, and you kind of move into stasis and stagnation. But the 70s was this massive oil boom, just unbelievable. And, you know, oil went from like 62 cents a barrel to 370. I mean, it doesn't sound like much, but on a proportional basis, huge. And that, even today, they'll talk about the boom, and that was where the Bin Laden family made their fortune. It's a huge fortune through these construction projects. And when I was in Saudi, people would talk wistfully going back to the boom, and the government would say, "Well, we would like a road between, you know, Jeddah and Riyadh," or they would like a highway, you know, a circular highway around Riyadh or in Dhamran to the end. And they would say, "Would you build?" You know, they'd go to a company like Bechtel, or they'd go to a company, Korean company, and they say, "Would you build us this infrastructure and send us the bill?" So anybody that could drive a bulldozer, anybody could do anything, got incredibly wealthy, and you build a piece of road, you invoice the Saudi government for a couple million bucks, and they pay. And there was no, anyway, it was incredible. And it was probably a one-time thing. But the thing is, with all this oil, became sort of stagnation and lack of modernity. No need to market. Yeah.
Was it a boom in production or a boom in demand? Or I mean,
it was a boom in not necessarily oil production. It was a boom in revenue to the House of Saud.
It's open.
Okay.
There's a supply. That's when the oil producing. Whatever it gets you.
Right. Organization.
Right. Yeah. Oh, right. Organization Patron exporting
countries. And
it's like the subprime crisis.
Okay.
People lost confidence in really this. Whoa, what's going to happen?
Big panic. So, again, we go back to this thing where these dictators ally themselves with extremist clerics. When you have economic stagnation, we have political stagnation. I spent time in Saudi, and there is great resentment against the House of Saud. It's underneath the surface there. This is an oppressive regime. You don't speak out of place, and they have a special political prison. And we were driving outside Riyadh once, and they said, "Now we're going to drive down this wing of this highway. You're not supposed to look left as we go by." So of course I go left. But it is a huge complex, and it's basically underground. And if you speak out and are a sort of a firebrand or oppose the House of Saud, that's where you get to be. And it's very, very severe. They continue to, if you're a criminal, not if you steal for the first time, but if you're a repeat offender, they will start hacking off body parts. They will, and they'll do it publicly. And there's a square in Riyadh, and I made sure that I was nowhere near that square on the days of execution. They also decapitate. That's their, and it's public decapitation. Anyway, it's like the Middle Ages as far as in you start cutting up body parts. It's not very nice. And there's a certain clarity. So they say, well, you know, the crime rate in Saudi is fairly low. And if someone walks into your store, you know, and they've got one of these, they say, we're going to watch this person. That person's a thief. Okay, so it's it has its supporters still. Anyway, the dictators and everyone is allied with the extremist clerics to contain this dissent, and we're getting rid of the full blush now of Wahhabism. And that is where all reformers and modernization, both those are legitimate targets of jihad, and not just jihad, but violent jihad. And with the role of this partnership between the House of Saud and the Wahhabi clerics, and the House of Saud funding many mosques around the world, and madrasas that teach very conservative Islam, this becomes a globalization of Wahhabi Islam. Okay. So, folks are not happy in the street. There's huge sadness, resentment, chip on the shoulder type thing from the history, from the Six-Day War. And then 1973, we get to the Yom Kippur War, which is Israel versus Egypt and Syria, and Jordan stays out. Okay. And I have a number of friends, well, everybody in Israel, as you know, is in the Israeli Defense Forces, the IDF, and I have a number of friends that fought in the Yom Kippur War. And that was, despite what is portrayed in the media or his history books, that was a very close thing. They almost lost. Okay. And a friend in Haifa, who took me up on the Golan and showed me where they fought and where his friends died, he said if the Jordanians came in when they shouldn't have and they stayed out when they could have, and it was so close. The Golan, the Golan is the heights, and it's really Syrian land, but it's the heights in between Syria and Northern Galilee. And for years and years and years, the Syrians had artillery up there and was lobbing shells down into the Kibbutz Im. Okay. So whatever you hear, Israel's never given that sucker back. It may become sort of neutral, third-party UN blue hat type of thing, but that's never going back.
That'd be insane.
And that's never going back. But at one point during Yom Kippur, the Yom Kippur War, Israel, for public opinion, world opinion, you know, was seen as sort of this bellicose power beating up on the Arabs. And so it knew something was afoot, but it decided not to mobilize. Okay? Because once you mobilize, then people can say, look, you're moving all these troops, we gotta come against you, we gotta preempt you. So Israel decided that they were gonna take the first hit, that they weren't gonna mobilize. And this was a huge gut check. Okay? Because whoever hits first hits seriously hard. Okay. So the Egyptians come screaming over into Sinai. The Syrians, just hundreds and hundreds of tanks coming up. And at one point, the fighting, they almost reached the Golan, and there was one tank, there was one Israeli tank between the Syrians and Tel Aviv. That's close. So Israel, I mean, that was an amazing thing. And even though Israel ultimately prevailed, the perception was that there were these initial string of successes by the Arab armies, and that they offset, because they sort of regained their honor, they offset the humiliation of the Six-Day War. Okay, so even though they didn't roll into Tel Aviv, but they really bloodied the Israelis, that then that gave Sadat the cover, because he was, he wasn't overthrown then. I mean, he sort of brought honor back to Egypt and gave him the cover to sit with Begin and Carter in 78 and do the Camp David Accords. So that was very brave, and many times he said this was his death warrant when he signed the Accords. Let's move forward from the Yom Kippur to 79. We had the Shah of Iran. The Shah was a U.S. ally. There was tremendous exchange, if you remember, between Iran and the United States. A lot of student exchanges, a lot of faculty exchanges. And to this day, we have Iranian faculty at Concordia that came out just before the war. And one of her professors, she goes back every year to teach in Tehran, at the University of Tehran, under the auspices of the UN, because it's important that we keep hope alive, okay? That we keep this going back and forth. And Iran is not Arabic, it's Persian, and if you call them Arabic, they will correct you. They have a great and distinct history. Persepolis and Esfahan, just amazing history. And I think, just a little aside, I'm ultimately very optimistic that if the theocracy, if those folks can sort of die off, that the society is very young. 70% of the people are under 30. They have no memory, conscious memory of the days of the Shah or even of Khomeini, and are actually, even though the government has all this rhetoric, the people in the street are fascinated and quite pro-Western, pro-United States. Most educated folk in the Middle East, and rights for women. Women can vote. Women can be doctors. All this kind of stuff. A little aside, I kind of overspoke. Within the Arab community, this is distinct from the Persian community, the elite, and this is what Israelis will tell you, not what the New York Times will tell you, but what Israelis will tell you is that the Palestinians are the elite of the Arab world. Okay, and we're not talking about the folks in the camps, okay, which is the big focus. Okay, the elite of the Arab world are Palestinians, and they live in Jordan, and they live in Egypt, and they work in Saudi. They are highly educated. I worked with world-class engineers in Saudi, because the Saudis really they haven't invested in their people. They have very limited abilities. The Palestinians, traditionally, are cosmopolitan. They're great business people, and they're highly educated. So be wary of the American media's portrayal. One of the few mainline newspapers is the Christian Science Monitor that gives them a fair shake. Okay. New York Times does.
Okay. Kit?
Yeah.
I just would like to expand a bit when you said on the El Nakba, and you referred to it as the humiliation.
Yeah.
The reality was it was ethnic cleansing of the Palestinians, and 800,000 Palestinians were forced out of what is now Israel, and that they're denied any. Their human rights under international law are denied. And so you have this injustice, and it's well documented now by an Israeli historian, Alon Pape, in his book, The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine, because of the documents just pre-Israel's formation and once Israel had formed that had been released publicly. And so that is, I think it's a kind of a distraction at times for people to think that this is just a, quote, a humiliation, when in fact it is a removal of a people from a land long historically theirs. And so it becomes, under international law, it was illegal. And when Israel was given, you know, recognized with statehood under the UN, the reality there was that they also, the state of Israel, was to grant the return of the refugees. But the Israeli forces had, or the Zionist forces had, also a plan to destroy the villages. About 480 villages, Palestinian villages within Israel, were bulldozed or moved into by Jewish people who had immigrated to Israel. And so you have something under international law and the basic human rights, a denial of this people to their land and their people.
I think that's fair. The what I'm trying to do in this session is understand this cumulative piece of resentment within the Arab world to the point where we get 18 people in a plane running into buildings 15 miles from where I teach.
So basically the not true balance, not true justice under international law, that is a source of resentment.
That's a source of resentment, and it's also, I'm always a bit of a contrarian, but the other, by the way, there's a, one of the board members here at Hafton through the years has done a lot of work with, good friend, done a lot of work with Palestinians. The other piece this is a bloody, messy bit. But the other Arab states who have great wealth, okay, Saudi doesn't let, gives some money, but won't, you have all these folk in the camps. They won't let those Palestinians go into Egypt. They won't let them go into Saudi.
Why should they have to move there?
The point is that they shouldn't have to move there. But the point is that these very wealthy Arab countries inflame tensions. This may be controversial. You can disagree with it, but they inflame tensions in the street against the West, against Israel, as a to divert domestic antipathy against their own internal injustices. And having seen stuff, you know, in Saudi, which, you know, you can't go there. You can't go there as a tourist. You have to be invited in, unless you're on the Hajj. And that's a very rigid, controlling state. And And Saudis tell me this, that the Israeli-Palestinian issue, they use that issue to deflect internal pressure, because that internal pressure is absolutely there. What I'd like to do before, you know, I'd like to go through the sequencing, and then we can come back around. So anyway, 1979, the fall of Shah, who ever thought that, you know, some unknown cleric who was actually had ties to the Muslim Brotherhood would come in and touch a raw nerve in Iran and to turn that society upside down. Iranians that I know say, you know, this is putting forward a distorted view of Islam and an illusion of returning to historic roots of when once, and it's mythology, but once when Islam was dominant and had a society that wasn't put upon. And so going back to an earlier time. And under Khomeini, with these, there was brutal suppression. And we all know that under the Shah, had a secret police, took care of, you know, killed people. But many more were killed under the revolution than were killed under the Shah. Also, it went to the very severe areas of Islamic law. And the Ayatollah Khomeini reduced, it was very difficult on women, they had to wear the hijab again, and also reduced the marriage age for girls from 18 to 9. And yet this is a very educated, modern society. Return also of Sharia law. And under Sharia law, depending on, there's different layers of it, what you enforce, what you don't enforce. The more restrictive Sharia law, let's say in Saudi, if there's a court case, a woman's testimony in court is worth one half of that of a man. And in Pakistan and Iran and Saudi, if a woman is raped, she runs the risk of being charged with zina. Particularly if she becomes pregnant, that means she had sex out of marriage with consent. And in order to prove an absence of consent, again, let's follow the logic here. To prove an absence of consent, a woman is required to provide four witnesses who are upstanding members of the community to the rape to say that it was without consent. Now, what four upstanding members of the community are going to be standing around watching a woman getting raped? It beggars imagination how this could possibly be a law, but it is what it is. And it's an impossible task to do. Okay, then, again, in the stream of things here, I will get to Sadat, and he was open to the West. Egypt is a modern country. He made peace with Israel, and he was criticized by the Ayatollah and the Muslim Brotherhood, and he called Khomeini a lunatic. And then in 1981, he was assassinated, and he knew he was going to be killed. And Sadat had, on several occasions, locked up Osama's aide, al-Zawahiri. So the world turns. I'd like to end on a, again, we'll have time for comment, and there are great wrongs in the Middle East. There's great divisions within the Israeli society, but there is. On most days, I'm hugely pessimistic that this thing is going to come right in my lifetime or my son's lifetime. But there is hope. And getting back to signs on the Arab street, there was. Just 2 years ago, the United States signed an agreement with Egypt and to the development of what's called a QIZ. We love acronyms, but that's a qualified industrial zone in Egypt. And they set up three of these in Egypt. And what does that mean? That means that products that were produced in those qualified industrial zones could be exported to the United States duty-free if they had more than 11% of the components from Israel. Okay. Because where there is trade and back and forth, people are in touch, they tend not to be at war where there is trade. And the key country, really, Turkey is this secular Islamic state, but the key country population-wise is Egypt. And if the model of Egypt can play out, there may be peace. There may not be peace, but there may be peace. And it's interesting that when the United States and the Egyptian government signed this this agreement for QIZ, there were in a number of cities in Egypt, there were big demonstrations in the street against Mubarak. Okay. And what were they demonstrating? They weren't demonstrating against Israel. They weren't demonstrating against the United States. They were demonstrating against Mubarak, because Mubarak had not included their town as a QIZ that could benefit with trade from Israel. So there are glimmers of opportunity. I wanted to end on a bit of a positive. We can do three-part, I won't go there, but I could do more three-part harmony on Saudi. Very good point on the Palestinians. They have caught the worst of this. But we should not view the Palestinians as the folks in the camps. Okay. There are very wealthy, very educated, the majority of Palestinians are not in the camps, and they have been put upon and abused. But what you see in the nightly news is not the reality of Palestinians that I've worked with in Saudi or Egypt. Okay. Yeah.
That QIZ is very interesting. How did that come to be?
That's part of a negotiation and modernity of Egypt deciding in a very rational way to, because most of Egypt's products don't come into the United States duty-free. And so this is a way of integrating economies, in a very intentional way. It didn't happen by accident. Of bringing together the signatories of the Camp David and then tying Israel economically. And Israel's all over the place economically with the Arab states. The Arab states just don't acknowledge it. But this is a very overt way and hopefully a sign for benefits to come. Yeah.
What do you see as the eventual outcome of all the Muslim population moving into other European countries? And talking about Sharia law in England.
Short answer, I don't know. But the problem is the setting up of walls and sort of ghettos in France and in Germany. And 10% of the population of the economies in Europe are Muslim now. And I don't know the demographic number, but it's not that far off where the majority of births are going to be in Muslim families, because the Europeans, are like 1.6 on replacement, and to have equilibrium, I think it's 2.1. So that's a great question, huge demographic shift. I don't know. That's a good question. Yeah.
I just wondering, you haven't mentioned what's going on now, though, in the West Bank. I was in the West Bank last year, and I can't see how there can possibly be peace between Israel and its neighbors with what they're doing to the Palestinians. The wall is one thing, the checkpoints, the constant checkpoints. I went through the checkpoints alone without being on a tour once, and it was just, the tour, they tried to give us a feeling. Well, it wasn't the feeling when I went alone with Palestinians. I can't see the possibility of peace unless the occupation ends. Have you been to Palestine and to the West Bank recently and seen how...
Not as recently as you, but again, most days I'm pessimistic with you. There's so much division and difficulty. There is, however, through Turkey, there's an active back channel negotiations. I think it's a drill. Back channel between Syria and Israel. And so I'm not. I have no great wisdom. My intent here was to show a bit of, that these 18 Saudis that came out of the air, the tradition was building, for centuries and centuries of Islam.
I just feel like, can I answer that maybe a little bit? I work in the heart of the Jewish peace movement in America, but also very closely with the Israeli peace movement in Israel. And so about every month or so we get updates, and what most people are feeling right now is that we're going to be moving towards a solution potentially in the next year or two, or we won't have a two-state solution anymore. That there's sort of, we're moving towards the end, but that doesn't mean it's not possible. And there's a lot of things happening both within Israel, and that we've seen sort of a shift in what people are interested in seeing as solutions. And also, and I don't know, people have different opinions on how much this matters, but also what I do is within the American Jewish movement, there's some huge changes happening in terms of what people are advocating and organizations that are being created to advocate for. And so I think there's a lot of people who definitely understand that nothing's going to be solved unless the occupation ends. A lot of people who are definitely working toward that end, but there's a lot of cynicism as well, both in Israeli society and Palestinian society. So it's kind of a big mess, but that doesn't mean that there aren't possibilities. And there's just one more thing, is that there's sort of two things happening. There's what happens on the ground and what happens on the policy level. And sometimes you look at the two and you're like, how could these both be happening? There's these peace talks happening, but there's settlements expanding and things like that. But that, a lot of that has to do with the internal dynamics within Israeli society as well, that, you know, keeping coalitions together means doing actions that are completely harmful to what they're actually trying to do and why they want to keep the coalition together in the first place. So in like 2 seconds, that's just a little bit of that.
I'm just going to ask you, what is your understanding historically of how the Shah of Iran came to power?
Well, he came to power with the assistance of the United States.
Right.
And,
and when he came to power, the reason he came to power was because the democracy in Iran had voted to nationalize oil.
That's correct.
So one of the things that we need to face as Americans is that when we look at an Arab world where we have militancy, we ask ourselves, have we as a country denied a nonviolent solution to the conflict?
Okay, I'm having a senior moment of the elected
Mossadegh,
thank you, was in negotiation with the United States and U.S. oil companies, and the Saudis cut a deal, you know, with Aramco, and they're looking to do another deal with him. This is not a sponge any responsibility to the United States, but the Iranians that I've talked to said that he had some mental or psychological issues and he wouldn't come out of bed in these negotiations. And I don't know if that's helpful or not, but there was these negotiations that went nowhere for revenue sharing, as with Aramco. But this is I glossed over it, I grant you, but this is a darker piece in our CIA history.
Yeah. That's the grandson of Teddy Roosevelt, that's correct.
My question is very basic. Are we on the right track in Iraq? Why are we there?
Well, that's beyond my portfolio.
Yeah. But it is part of the Middle East.
It is part of the Middle East. And what I will say is that the what I told my students as we were leading into this is that there was no question the U.S. military could take down the Iraqi military in 8 days. Next. And what a lot of people of whatever ilk, whatever party, signed on to do this, most probably in good faith, to go in that there were weapons of mass destruction. Now, in fact, we know this was cooked. I'm not that much of a cynic to say that Colin Powell was part of cooking the books. I have respect for him. I think Cheney and some of the neocons have been awful. But the bigger piece, I think, is a cultural piece, is we are innocents abroad. If we think we can go into the Middle East and get into the middle of a 1,000-year-old friction, and not look at this, what we just went through. I mean, not be resented and have people throw stuff at us. So I have no wisdom on it. I think people that looked at this that had been in the Middle East and just weren't policy wonks that had this neocon thing going on in their head, which would have said, you know, let's take a step here. And you know, I talked earlier this week about both Baker and Scowcroft, two former national security advisors in a Democratic and Republican administration, saying, you know, what on earth are you going to do after you get in? And you know, Rice, Cheney, and Bush didn't think it through.
You know, what's interesting to me, Kim, is that Cheney in 1991 said there was no way they were going to Baghdad. And I forget what his role was in the Bush administration then, but they wouldn't. Was he defense secretary? No.
Yes.
Anyway, he said they wouldn't go into Baghdad because what would you do there? How could you set up a government? How could you govern?
Right. So, but the broader piece is sort of culturally, what we'd be getting ourselves in the middle of, given this history going back to 1683, and they were just intentionally ignorant.
Changing the subject somewhat, is there any signs that there's going to be change with the House of Saud? One of the issues, such a wealthy country, so much unemployment, most of the young men, more than half the young men in Saudi Arabia, do not work, and the majority of the people on 9/11 were young Saudi men. And also all the money, a lot of money goes to Pakistan, for instance, to teach the schools, the Sharia schools. Is there any sign that someone or some group is going to come up against that now?
Well, they're actively working that doesn't happen. And I'd like to repeat a study that, you know, was sponsored by Senator Bill Bradley and then also espoused by Bobby Kennedy Jr., that if we had stayed with the CAFE, you know, corporate average fuel efficiency standards, by 1986 we would have been at, by 1990 we would have been at 40 plus miles per gallon, and we would not have to import one drop of Middle East oil. We still have to import Canadian and all that kind of stuff. That would change everything. And I see the resentment, I know the resentment, but there's a strong, I mean, the House of Saud, there's like 1,900 princes in the House of Saud, so it's a pervasive thing. And I don't see it changing. I don't see it changing.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.